You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
At the beginning of this month, the U.S. Department of Agriculture ditched the well-known and much-criticized food pyramid and introduced the food plate. The new food plate's simple message and intuitive design was positively received, and for some, it highlights the deficit of its counterpart in this country, the Canada Food Guide. Bill Jeffrey is national coordinator of the Center for Science and the Public Interest. He says that Canadians are hungry for straight talk on food and nutrition. And while the new food plate hits the spot, the Canada Food Guide does not. Bill Jeffrey joins me this morning from Ottawa. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
Now, the Canada Food Guide, it's kind of, to me, it's sort of an iconic publication. It's the kind of thing, if you grew up in Canada, that you remember being, you know, posted on your school bulletin boards. How widely is it distributed and consulted?
Well, it's actually apparently the second most popular government publication. Well, maybe popular is not the right word. The second most most widely distributed, next to the income tax return. So it may in fact be the most popular one. I think it's more widely distributed, on a per population basis than the U.S. food pyramid. So there's a real opportunity there, I think, to spread some common sense messages about the relationship between diet and disease that are actually based on, an honest review of the literature, scientific literature.
When did you start to question its credibility?
Well, our organization sort of led the charge in the non-governmental organization community for mandatory nutrition labeling. And it would from like 1996 to 2002, and when it became clear that Health Canada was going to pass regulations to mandate it, we were looking for other approaches to help reduce the burden of diet-related disease. And one of the things that we looked at was the food guide. And initially, we considered just advocating that government distribute it even more widely than it does now. But when we looked at the advice in it carefully, and in relation to the, the broad body of scientific literature, but the relationship between diet and disease, we thought it fell kind of short. And the more probing we did, the more kind of unsatisfactory answers Health Canada provided to some of the reasons why it was the way it was. Ultimately, they began a public consultation to talk about how to change it. And ultimately did change it in 2007 with some improvements, but there are still some sort of vestiges of the old approach, and some of the advice seems to be more about sidestepping conflicts with powerful parts of the food industry than giving people good science-based advice.
Now, precursor to the new food plate in the U.S. was the food pyramid, which was introduced in 2002. Tell us the story of the pyramid and its evolution.
Well, I mean, I'm a Canadian. I can only tell you so much about it, but I know that it had been criticized by a lot of dietitians from the very beginning as too difficult to understand. And during the Bush administration, there were efforts made to revise it, which I think by all accounts made it even more difficult to design. The original concept was that it's in the shape of a triangle or a pyramid, and with each sort of horizontal bar representing a different food group, and the idea was the one at the bottom was the one you were supposed to eat the most of, and it occupied the most sort of square centimeters or whatever. And then as you go up, it'd be less and less. But when the Bush administration changed it, they actually stopped using it that way and started drawing lines from the bottom to the apex of the top, and so it was slices from the bottom to the top that were supposed to represent the different food groups, and it seemed kind of bizarre to the extreme, and it was difficult to imagine a worse way to communicate that nutrition information. And so I think with this food plate, everyone would agree anything would have been an improvement. And I think, it's not perfect, but it certainly is a much more useful tool than the food pyramid was.
How does the food plate work? Because I've seen a picture of it. It's like pretty basic. It looks like a pie chart.
Yeah, and it looks like something that we all look at every day. When you eat a meal, typically you eat it on a plate. And so it does graphically represent that fruits and vegetables have to be basically about half of your servings. And I think it's important to kind of stress that, and the food plate does that well. And also there's a little quadrant called protein, and I think in a way that's better than the term that we use in Canada's Food Guide, which is meat and alternatives, because the preponderance of scientific evidence indicates that we should be consuming legumes and beans and nuts for our protein, and fish and poultry, not meat. We're not suffering from a deficiency of beef consumption in this country, and typically beef is, other types of red meat are associated with increased risk of certain forms of cancer, and they tend to be higher in saturated fat. Not all kinds of beef, but as a category of food, it's quite often quite high in saturated fat, and that, of course, is associated with increased risk of heart disease. And there are lots of foods that actually do help us help protect us from certain forms of cancer, heart disease, and diabetes. And those are the types of foods that we think the Food Guide in both Canada and the United States should be promoting.
Now, let's come back for a moment to the Canadian government's Food Guide. What's wrong with the current version of that? Where does that sort of not line up with the science?
Well, in some ways it's hard to compare it to the plate, the U.S. food plate, because the Canadian guide is a 6-page document that, in a way, it provides what I think is a lot of sort of small print information. It doesn't really put the key information in the headlines, if you like. Just by way of example, probably the two most important nutrition-related health problems in Canada are too much sodium in our diets and too many calories. And sodium is mentioned in the food guide, but it's nowhere is it stressed that as many as 16,000 people may die prematurely in Canada from excess sodium in their diets. The day that the new version was released, a lot of reporters asked our Minister of Health at the time, Tony Clement, and the Chief Public Health Officer, Dr. Butler Jones, where the advice was about calories, because they had been reporting for years about this obesity epidemic, but they didn't see any reference to it in the food guide. With 2/3 of people overweight or obese, and the lifetime risk of having high blood pressure, a lot of which is associated with excess sodium intake, being 90%. 90% of people get high blood pressure at some point during their lives. It seemed almost like mysterious why those two things were scarcely noted in the food guide. And it's that kind of thing that makes us have less confidence in it, and so we have been urging Health Canada to consider refining it again through a more open process, and revealing the scientific basis for all of the changes that it makes to the advice and to the presentation. It seemed the last time around there were some changes made to it, but it wasn't really explained why, and it was kind of a non-transparent process. That's, I think, problematic.
What's one of the things that's kind of interesting to me is that in the current food guide in 2007, I understand that they reduced the number of minimum number of vegetables that you might eat. Which I'm vegetarian, so I find that I've never thought about how I need to make sure I don't overdo it with my vegetables.
Yeah, the 1992 guide recommended 5 to 10 servings a day, and the current guide recommends 4 to 10. That's partly because it applies to younger children between the ages of 2 and 4, and the older one just started at age 4. But there was a proposal along the way when they were about to come up with this 2007 version of the guide, where they actually recommended 4 to 9 servings, and it seemed odd to me, almost like a typo. Like, who would recommend consuming fewer fruits and vegetables when all the other, like the dairy and the meat recommendations were kept the same? And so we pressed Health Canada on this quite vigorously, and some of the disease charity groups did too, because they had public education campaigns that were based on fruit and vegetable intake. And Health Canada's primary explanation for this proposed change, which fortunately they backed off on, was that it was an effort to help Canadians consume fewer calories. Consuming fewer fruits and vegetables was their effort to help people lose weight, which just seemed, again, quite mysterious to me. And it just made me perk my ears up more about the development of the guide and the consistency with the scientific evidence.
Does the guide distinguish between foods that have a health-enhancing or, you know, increase people's health, things like what I think of fruits and vegetables, for instance, and you know, foods that might have a detrimental effect but still fit within a category?
Yeah, well, it doesn't do that very well. I mean, one thing I will say in defense of the guide is they did on the back page, they made a list under a section called Eat Well, a list of about 20 foods, you know, that include, you know, fats and sugars and cookies and candies and that sort of thing, that they're discouraging, and which I think is a step forward. In the past, they had been very reticent to actually discourage consuming any foods. Their view was they wanted it to be a positive message. But you have to tell people the good news and the bad news, in our view. But still, though, one of our continuing kind of grievances with the guide is, like in the dairy section, they recommend sort of cheese almost on the same footing as milk. And cheese is a major source of saturated fat. It has much more saturated fat than at least skim or 1% milk. And often some of these alternatives don't have much vitamin D in them. And so it seemed kind of like a peculiar thing that they would put them on the same footing. And likewise, so much evidence demonstrates the beneficial effects of consuming whole grain products. And yet still we see white bread type products depicted in the guide, and the advice is only to consume half of your grains as whole grains. And to us, that just doesn't really make any sense. Why aren't they promoting the truly nutritious food instead of, you know, treating white bread like it's on the same footing pretty much?
Bill, what would government involvement in food regulation and education look like if it was evidence-based and put public health first?
Well, I mean, I think from a mechanical process of the consultation, everything would be on the public record. I mean, and this is one way in which, in a lot of ways, the Americans are so far ahead of us. When there's a public consultation held here, you have to file an access to information request, and in my experience, wait sometimes years to get the responses back to find out what other parties were saying. And a lot of times, I'm sure people have meetings with government officials that, you know, are oral meetings, and there's no written submission, and there may not be any record of it at all. But I think certainly in the case of the food guide and a lot of other policies, if they were required to be based on science and public health, without commercial interests undermining them, I think our policies would look much different. We'd have front-of-pack nutrition labeling instead of back-of-pack nutrition labeling. We would have long ago restricted advertising directed at children, as they have in Quebec since 1980, instead of, you know, humming and hawing at the policy in the policy communities about whether it's a good idea. I mean, the list goes on, the food guide just being one of many examples.
Well, it's been good talking with you this morning, Bill. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
I've been speaking with Bill Jeffrey. He's the National Coordinator of the Center for Science in the Public Interest.